The committee will come to order. Welcome everyone to the House Elections Committee. We do have a quorum, so we can proceed, although we won't be taking any action today. Welcome everyone to the Elections Committee. It's my pleasure to be the chair of the committee. I don't need to tell all of you that elections are very important to all of us because we're elected officials. But even more than that, I suspect that before we were elected officials, we cared about elections and cared enough about policy and outcomes in our state to know that elections really matter. And so you're here for a reason, and hopefully it's to do some good work. And I think we can do a lot of good work together this session. It's no secret that in times past, it's natural for both parties to seek to sort of game the system when it comes to elections to advantage their party. It's a natural, normal, rational instinct. But fortunately, from my vantage point in this area, we have a tradition now, going back at least two governors, one Democrat, one Republican, saying that they will not sign election-related legislation unless it's bipartisan. Governor Pawlenty certainly had that policy, and Governor Dayton has carried that forward, and I think it's a good idea. And we take it seriously. I understand that he's assured many people before and since the election that that's his intention, and I take him at his word. And I hope that that sets the tone for our work in this committee. And in a sense, it's a relief. I think it kind of takes the pressure off of both sides. In terms of Democrats, there may be friends, allies, others who want Democrats to push for certain legislation, and we can very legitimately say, sorry, that's going to sort of be a waste of time because it's not going to garner bipartisan support, and we're just not going to spend a lot or any time on that kind of thing. And I would imagine that it takes some pressure off Republicans as well, because there's no reason to throw bombs or do other things because we're going to work in a bipartisan fashion. At least that's my hope. That's the theory, and I hope that's the way it'll be in practice. So I hope we can be more kind of problem solvers in this room. We're also in the basement hearing room, which means no cameras, so we don't have to pimp and posture as much as you might if you were in room 200. Occasionally, I'm sure there might be a camera in here from the outside, but in terms of House television, we're always on the audio, of course, but we're not televised. So I hope that just ratchets things down a little bit, that in combination with the governor's pronouncements and with, I think, the makeup of the committee. I've worked with some of you very closely before in both parties, and others of you I know by reputation or who have met, and I think we've got a really good group here of responsible, thoughtful people, of course, who have their partisan leanings, strong partisan leanings and preferences. I'm not trying to take the politics out of politics. I understand there's a place for it, but in this committee, it's my hope, at least, that we can work together, and we're going to have to, because if we don't, stuff just isn't going to get signed, and it's just not going to get done. So I hope in that spirit we can go forward. You'll notice that there are assigned seats in this committee, and there are other rules, which we'll talk about in a minute, that are a lot looser. This is one of the few that I think are a little tighter, and there's a reason for that we decided to seat by seniority. And that is that in most committees, and I'm as much a part of this as any member, I suspect, there's a natural sort of partisan tribalism that takes hold. It's natural, it's normal, it's rational. You tend to sit by the people you know in caucus and people in your own party, and that's perfectly fine, and I do it myself, or tend to do it. But I think in this committee, it's important than most other committees, more important than most other committees, that we foster early and formally an atmosphere that is less inherently partisan. I understand the subject matter is, and I'm not naive about the stakes for this or that political party, but I think seating is just one way for us to mix it up a little bit and make it less of this sort of tribalist, segregated atmosphere. So I hope you'll bear with me on that, and we do ask that you sit in your assigned seats. If you look at the other rules in your packet, there's just a sheet of rules, nothing surprising to those of you who've been around here. It's basically a cut-and-paste job. It's the normal rules you'd expect. We do have a 5 p.m. the night before rule, not quite 24-hour rule, but as you can see, there are escape hatches and always reasonable exceptions. Just use your best judgment. I think we all want to treat each other with courtesy, and this isn't just about us, it's about the public as well. The public has a right to know what's coming down the pike with some notice. So if you have a problem meeting the 5 p.m. deadline, you can contact me or some of the staff who you'll meet in a minute. You'll notice I didn't put a prohibition on there on mobile phones or anything like that, because we all use them, we all look at them, and even in committees where it's against the rules, people are out with their phones, and so if you can't beat them, join them. And good luck, though, getting reception in the basement. Yeah. I found that that's So you're welcome to use it, but the Weissman hearing room is tough, at least if you're with my carrier that I use. So that's not in the rules, and I think the rules are pretty much what you've seen before. Just a reasonable heads up when it comes to amendments and that sort of thing, but hopefully we'll have worked out some of those issues before. Before I get to kind of the main event today and what we're here for, I just wanted to do the obligatory introductions. And why don't we go around staff and members, and I'll start this way and we'll go around this way, and just introduce yourself, if you're a member, where you're from, and regardless of whether you're a member or not, tell us where you went to high school. That's the one thing that I think would be key. So I'm Steve Simon. I represent Hopkins in St. Louis Park, District 46B, which is happily where I also grew up. I went to Hopkins High School, and that's an added pleasure for me being in the legislature, is that I get to represent my old stomping grounds and old neighborhoods. In my other life, I'm a lawyer. I'm married. I have a 5-week-old daughter, and I'm happy to be chairing the committee.
Jim Geldman, committee administrator. I went to St. Bernard's High School in St. Paul.
I'm Matt Gehring from Nonpartisan House Research, and I went to Eau Claire North High School in Wisconsin.
Carlos Spadiani, District 65B, which is the central part of St. Paul. In fact, the capital is in my district, and if it warms up, you'll catch me walking home some days. It's about a 3-mile walk to my home. My kids graduated from Central and Highland Park High School in St. Paul. I attended high school by the name of Lane Tech. I'll let you figure out what city that was in. Chicago.
I'm Representative Dean Erdahl. Represent Meeker County and 3 townships in McLeod, 1 township in Wright. I'm a Litchfield Dragon High School. And at New London Spicer, I coach cross country running, which for boys was a 3-mile race. And you should jog at home. Don't just walk it, Carlos.
Hello, I'm Connie Bernardi, and I represent District 41A, which is New Brighton, Fridley, and Springley Park, and I'm a proud graduate of Springley Park High School. So I also grew up in the community in which I represent, which is a great honor to do that. And my husband, Dan, and I, we've been married for 27 years. We have, our 2 daughters are now in college, and I served in the legislature for 6 years and took off 6 years so I could spend more time with them, and now I'm back and pleased to serve on this committee. I think it's an important issue for our state. Thanks.
Ryan Winkler, representing Golden Valley, St. Louis Park, the northern, better half of St. Louis Park.
Yeah.
Plymouth, part of Plymouth, and the community of Medicine Lake. I've been in the elections committee in the House for the last 6 years. I'm a proud Bemidji lumberjack.
Tim O'Driscoll, 13B. This is my second term in the legislature and my second tour of duty on elections as well. A graduate of Sartell St. Stephen High School, which, as many of the other members have indicated, that's also part of the district that I represent, so I do share that same pride of representing my hometown.
Joe Marbo, I'm the GOP research for the committee. I covered GovOps, which included elections 2007-10, and covered the State Government Finance Committee the last couple of years, which we did a lot of election stuff too with committee administrator. And I attended Minneapolis Washburn High School, and I'm a resident of Chair Simon's district.
Britton House with DFL Caucus Research. I went to Fort Atkinson Senior High School in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin.
Brian Johnson. I represent most of 2/3 of Isani County and the northern third of Chisago County. Went to school in Cambridge. That's where I've pretty much spent my entire life. Just retired as of yesterday at 5 o'clock from the Isani County Sheriff's Office as a deputy sheriff.
Congratulations.
I'm Kurt Dout, District 31A, which is southern part of Isani County, part of Sherburne County, and the northern sliver of Anoka County. I went to high school actually in Princeton, and as I mentioned on the floor last week, Sandra Erickson was one of my high school teachers. So Representative Sandra Erickson. My favorite color is red, and I have a black lab that's 7.5 months old named Lucy. So.
I'm Carolyn Lane, and I represent New Brighton, St. Anthony, and New Brighton, and Columbia Heights. Grew up in Hibbing, went to Hibbing High School. If you saw on CCO recently, they had a piece on Hibbing High School, which was built with taconite money, and it was very, very elegant. I just took it for granted. Beautiful auditorium with Czechoslovakian chandeliers and murals on the walls, and it was just a beautiful place to grow up. And so here I am.
I'm Representative Tom Huntley from District 7A, which is the eastern part of the city of Duluth. Actually, if you looked at the map, you'll see it's on an angle, and so we really ought to call it northeast. But I graduated from St. Leo's School in grade school in St. Paul and Creighton High School. So everything that's wrong with me is due to the nuns and the brothers. I will say it's kind of interesting because Mike Paymar represents the neighborhood that I grew up in, and I represent the neighborhood that he grew up in.
Good afternoon. Tim Sanders, represent Blaine, and I went to high school at Tremper High School in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
And I should add that Representative Sanders is the lead Republican member on the committee. Next is our vice chair.
Hi, I'm Lori Halverson. I graduated from Chisago Lakes High School in Lindstrom, Minnesota, and I represent Egan's District 51B.
My name is Andrew Verdon. I'm a committee legislative assistant. Went to St. Andrews High School in Middletown, Delaware.
Okay, well, I think that rounds out the introductions. We've got a great group here. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a roadmap. So this hearing today, obviously, as you can see, is devoted to an overview of the Minnesota election system. We have members here who are new to the legislature and some members here who are not new to the legislature but new to this issue area. But even for those who have always served on this committee, and I'm one of those, it's really these overviews are very useful, I think, of this system, because not only is it a technical area that's changing a lot, but I always learn something from this, and they do a very good job. So we're going to hear from the Secretary of State's office and also from some of the county folks who help administer the elections. And just in terms of the future, on Thursday we're going to continue with an overview. Well, first we're going to have some testimony, probably fairly briefly, about some of the election delays or irregularities that happened in the last election, both in greater Minnesota and in the metro area. And then we're going to get to an overview from the Campaign Finance Board, because remember, part of the jurisdiction of this committee is not just the Secretary of State's office and the mechanics of and processes and procedures of elections, but it's also the campaign finance system as well. So we'll have that overview. And then a week from today, on Tuesday the 22nd, I have what I guess you could call an open mic sort of hearing. I thought it would be a good idea to have testify before us in increments of 10, 15 minutes, depending on how many we have, representatives from groups that make it their priority to talk about and advocate in the space of elections. And the idea is for them to come here and just tell us, in however much time allotted, how they see the Minnesota election system, good, bad, or otherwise, what changes they want to see or what changes they desperately don't want to see, and for us to ask them a few questions. And I really want to make sure we have a diversity of viewpoints, and we've invited groups left, right, and center, and we're sort of shoring up that, and we have several yeses already. So that's the plan for the next three hearings, and then pretty soon, before you know it, we'll be hearing some bills. And as I say, I hope we have a good climate of cooperation here. With that, let me ask the presenters to come up. And members, I think what we'll do is not interrupt the presentation with questions yet. I'd really like them to finish the presentation, and I promise we'll leave ample time for questions. And if I think we're in danger of not having that, so you can exhaust all your questions or comments, I'll tell the presenters, and I hope the presenters know this, to speed it up if need be, because I do want to make sure we have time for questions. So with that, if you could introduce yourselves for the committee and for the record, please.
I'm Gary Poser. I'm the Director of Elections for the Office of the Secretary of State.
I'm Deborah Erickson, Elections Coordinator for Crow Wing County and the Chair of the Minnesota Association of County Officers Elections Committee.
Okay. go ahead, Mr. Poser, and just be mindful of the time. I'd like to leave, you know, a good chunk of time at the end for questions or comments of any kind from the members. Thanks.
Okay. So I'll start out with the Secretary of State's duties in the elections area. Obviously, the Secretary of State's office has other duties as well. The Secretary of State is the chief state election official. It means they're really the highest ranking election official in the state. It doesn't mean that we have enforcement over authority over the local election officials. They all have their own duties prescribed by statute. One of the duties that we do at the state is train and certify the county election administrators. So we go through every election year and go through the laws and what their duties are. We also administer the statewide voter registration system. It's one of the things you'll find on that terminology referred to as SVRS, is how we will shorten that to. It's really a centralized database of all of the voter registration records in the state, and it's maintained by the county auditors. It's used to also track and process absentee ballots, so it's required to be used for all absentees in the state general election years. It also interfaces with some of the other state government agencies. We interface with driver and vehicle services for getting driver's license registrations, and then also to verify information on registration cards. We also interface then through DVS, going to the Social Security Administration for people who provide the last four digits of their Social Security number on their voter registration application. We interface with the courts to get any felon information from them. Those can come through at any time. Any guardianships, which have voter rights removed, come to us from the courts, as well as any name changes that occur in the courts are sent to us as well. We also interface with the Department of Health, so we also get all of the deaths that happen within the state and compare those to the voter registration records as well. we also, this database is also, if you've gone on our website, you can look up, any voter can look up to see if they are registered to vote. This database supports that, and it also supports anybody looking up their absentee ballot status, so to see whether a ballot's been sent to them, whether it's been accepted or rejected, those types of things. The state also certifies any election equipment, so any vendor that wants to sell voting equipment in the state needs to come to the Secretary of State's office to have their equipment certified that it meets Minnesota's election laws. And the system also is used to conduct matches between some other data that we just exchanged database-wise. One of them is with the U.S. Postal Service. We compare to the national change of address to see if any of our registered voters might have submitted a permanent change of address through the post office. We also get data on those people that are incarcerated with the Department of Corrections, again looking for felons to see whether or not they should be challenged in our records. And we also get data on non-citizens from the Department of Public Safety for anybody that's provided that information to them as part of the driver's license process. And that's kind of a quick overview of some of the Secretary of State's duties, and then I'll let Debbie talk about the county auditor's duties.
From the standpoint of the county auditor, we administer a lot of the items that Mr. Poser was just talking about with regard to the state voter registration system. Keep in mind that of 87 counties in Minnesota, the majority of the county auditors have more duties than just elections. Some of your larger counties will have separate elections divisions, but often elections is just a portion of the duties that are being performed. When we talk about the county's responsibilities for voter registration, the interfaces that are done with the different systems that are in place through the Secretary of State's office then requires the auditors to do the inputs of all the data that comes through on the paper forms that come into our office. In 2012, there were 650,000 updates to 322,000 plus voters prior to Election Day. This is allowing us to verify that all the information that the voters have put on their forms is accurate and matches those database matches that was mentioned at the state level. We're also required to send non-forwardable postal return cards to every voter who registers or updates their registration. When those are returned, we then have additional steps that are gone through to ensure that the voter truly does reside at the location of where they are saying they live. Reviewing the data in SVRS on deaths, felony convictions, and guardianships allows us to then place challenges on a voter's record, which the voter must clear in order to be able to register and or vote. And if there are violations or items that come up, the auditors are responsible for forwarding that information to the county attorneys for possible review and prosecution. Once an election is complete, we then have to enter the data from that election. Keep in mind that if a voter doesn't vote at least once every 4 years, their record is inactivated and they must re-register before they can vote again. So we need to post all the history from each election to keep their records accurate. And we also enter all voters who registered on election day. That data gets entered into SVRS at that time, which in 2012, over 527,000 people registered at the polls on election day. So all that work is accomplished after the election. Prior to election day, the auditors also need to make sure that they are overseeing the ballot layout and printing for the state elections and any elections that have county offices as well. Part of that process entails ensuring that all offices are on the ballot. At a local level, at the county and precinct level, not only do you have your city, state, federal, county, you also have school districts and in some cases hospital districts or other local offices as well. By making sure that we have all the ballot styles and completely laid out correctly for the ballots, then we can go on to the testing phase of our equipment. One of the other options or duties that the auditors have is to make sure that all the supplies and materials, including election equipment, is ready and available at the polls on election day. The testing process that is in place in statute and rule requires that we test every piece of equipment and every style of ballot that before it goes to the polls on election day. With all those different offices that are on a ballot, when you have a municipality that has multiple precincts, in some cases you can have hundreds or thousands of ballot styles within the same county. So every style of ballot has to be tested, as well as every piece of equipment to make sure that it's all functioning correctly. One of the other duties that auditors have at the county level is to issue and maintain the absentee ballot process. This includes all absentee ballots for state, local, and federal elections, as well as county elections. And at the local municipal level, we also issue UACAVA, which are the overseas or military absentee ballots, for all election, regardless of what level it is located at. As the Secretary of State is responsible for training the counties are responsible for training the local election officials. We train the city and township and school district clerks, as well as the election judges who work in the polls on election day. The election judges are required by law to have 2 hours of training every 2 years. However, we found that all the stuff you have to cover to be a successful election judge is very difficult to fit into 2 hours. So we want to make sure that they're well prepared and we give them the appropriate training. Once the election is complete, we are responsible for compiling the election results and submitting them to the Secretary of State. There are three different ways that that can be accomplished. One, we have some precincts who are modeming their results directly from the polling location to the Secretary of State's website. We have some precincts where they return their supplies and their materials to a central location like the county courthouse, and they are then uploaded and sent to the Secretary of State's site. And we have some precincts where the auditor is manually entering the results off the machine tape that the election judges have certified. So there are three different ways. And also keep in mind that with the addition of an absentee ballot board, now polling place and absentee results have to be combined before the precinct results can be released. So that is all coordinated at the county level and then released to the Secretary of State's website. Finally, after the election is complete, we're also required to conduct the post-election audit. Now, the post-election audit does require us to randomly select a couple of precincts and hand count the votes for two or three offices on each race to ensure that they were counted as they were supposed to be by the machines. The municipal clerk is also responsible at the city or township level for a number of different duties on their end as well. And municipal clerks are responsible to determine the polling place locations as well as their precinct boundaries. While the auditors train the election judges, often your cities are responsible for recruiting and hiring election judges as well as assigning them to the precincts based on maintaining the party balance that's required in statute. They also are responsible for sending election judges who have been trained to healthcare facilities such as nursing homes or hospitals if they have those establishments in their precincts to do the healthcare outreach and absentee voting. In some cases, counties have delegated the absentee voting responsibility to the cities, and the cities could then administer that process if that's occurred. And in a standalone election, like the upcoming township elections in March, the municipal clerks are responsible for administering absentees for those local elections. Finally, at the county attorney level, the county attorney is the chief counsel to the counties with regard to election-related issues, and are required to investigate any items that have been turned over by the county auditor for investigation with regard to election situations. And I think Carrie's going to talk a little bit about absentee process.
In-person voting.
In-person voting.
I'll do both. So we'll start with just in-person voting, just to give you an idea. Most of you have gone through the polling places, so you should understand this process. There are really around in the state around 30,000 election judges that man the polling places on election day. So when Debbie's talking about a lot of training, the counties are training 30,000 people to handle that job for election day. We have just around 4,000 precincts, a little bit more, but some of them are mail ballot precincts that Debbie will talk about later. There are a minimum of 4 election judges that are required in each precinct that's open on election day. Of course, some of the larger precincts will have more. Some of them might have more than 15 election judges manning that polling place on election day. As Debbie mentioned, all of those election judges get 2 hours of training. The chair judge or the head election judge in each of those precincts is required to have an additional 1 hour of training for the more difficult tasks that need to be done in the polling place as well. And there are judges from at least 2 of the major political parties that must be present in each polling place for some of the duties that require to have judges from different parties do certain tasks. And obviously when a voter then comes in to vote, they sign an oath. So on that roster, at the top of the roster that they sign, is an oath stating that they are eligible to vote. The election judges also then conduct a challenged voter process. So a voter could be challenged through the registration process. So on the roster, it could already have a challenge if the county auditor has received a return postcard or something like that, a felon notification from the courts. Those things would be on the roster. So if it's pre-marked on the roster, there could be a challenge made by the election judges. A challenger from one of the political parties might be in the polling place who could do a challenge, and the election judges themselves could have reason to challenge a voter. So that process is handled by the election judges themselves. The election judges also then conduct election day registration in the polling place. So they would then determine that that person is not already registered in the polling place, either from the roster or on a master list that they have available to them. They determine that the voter's in the right polling place, so they need to check either a map or a precinct finder that has address ranges. So they need to look at the address being provided by the voter to see that they belong in that polling place, where they are registering. They also determine that the voter has not voted an absentee ballot that's been accepted. Again, either having been pre-marked on the roster or getting some reports on election day, and we'll talk about absentee voting in a little bit. They also have to provide an authorized proof of residence and show that to the election judge before they're allowed to complete the election day process. And then once they have gone through all of the steps necessary to register, they sign that registration application form, and then they also sign a roster just like any other voter who was pre-registered. They sign that same oath on a roster in order to get a ballot to vote. The election judges also, at the end of the night when their polling has finished, they also reconcile the number of ballots that will be counted that are in their ballot box with the number of voters that have signed the rosters and received that voter receipt to get a ballot. And in the end, they sign then what we call a summary statement, or that is the certification of their precinct-level results. So the official results that come from that polling place are signed by the election judges that are saying that those are the official results in the precinct. Okay, I'm also going to talk a little bit about absentee voting, absentee balloting. You'll see we call it AB a lot if you look at the terminology handout. There are really 2 different kinds of absentee ballots that I'll talk about. One is just for the regular absentee voters. Those are the voters who are residing here in the state and are just will have a reason that we'll discuss as well. And the second type is the military and overseas voters. We call them UOCAVA voters for a federal law. It's the Uniformed or Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. So we'll either say UOCAVA, a lot of times we'll say military and overseas voters just to keep people knowing which voters we're talking about. So for the regular absentee voting, That is administered by the county auditors, and sometimes a municipal clerk might do that if they've been delegated by the county. Again, as I mentioned, for state elections, so those the state primary, state general, and the even year, the absentee ballots are required to be recorded in the statewide registration system. The system is available for other elections as well, but they must be used in SBRS for the state elections. Absentee voting can happen by mail, and it can also happen in person at the election official's office. So if a county auditor will always have their counter people voting absentee. If a city is designated to do absentee, they can have voters coming up to the clerk's counter as well. You're only allowed to vote by a regular absentee if certain conditions apply. Basically, that means you have an illness or a disability. You might have a religious reason, or you could be away from the precinct and not be able to go to your polling place. But you must have one of those reasons in order to get an absentee ballot. And in order to get that ballot, you must apply for that absentee ballot. So you have to sign an application that, again, has an oath on it, similar to the oath on the voter registration application that says that you are eligible to vote by an absentee ballot. For the state elections, the absentee ballots must be ready 46 days before the election. This, again, was the reason why we moved the state primary to August, was to allow for a 46-day absentee period prior to the November election. And then when voting an absentee ballot, that voter must have a witness certify that they saw the ballot was blank and that voter filled out that ballot. That witness can be another Minnesota voter. They might be a notary public for people that are out of state. And if they're voting at the counter, obviously the county auditor or their staff are authorized to administer oaths, and they can be that witness as well. The counties and cities, if they are delegated, must have an absentee ballot board. The ballot board is going to review all of the absentee ballots that have been returned by the voters and decide whether to accept them or reject them. So they must review those absentee ballots within 3 to 5 days after they've been received back to ensure that the ballots are properly completed, the envelopes are properly completed. If everything is proper, they must accept those ballots. If it's not properly completed, they must reject those absentee ballots. And once they've rejected an absentee ballot, they need to contact the voter. If they reject it more than 5 days before the election, they must send that voter a replacement absentee ballot, giving that voter a chance to fix the error. And they along with the replacement ballot, they send an explanation along saying why their ballot was originally rejected in the first place. When we get closer to the election, so we're within 5 days of the election, and there's not time to ensure that a mailed ballot, replacement ballot, will be able to get to them, the official then is required to attempt to contact the voter. So they might try and call them by phone. They might email them if they put an email address on their application. But they're trying to contact the voter to tell them that your ballot has been rejected and give them their options of coming in to the office to do a replacement ballot, maybe still try to mail it out, or they could still then go to the polling place on election day. As of the close of business or 5 p.m. on that Friday before the election, absentees then that have been accepted are considered final, and at that point you could no longer then go to the polling place and vote in person. And that's the point when the counties or the cities can begin to process the accepted absentee ballots. So they must ensure that the rosters have an AB next to that voter's line so that that voter now has an absentee ballot and can't vote in person at the polling place. They remove ballots from both of the envelopes and they can begin then feeding them into the machines to begin the process to start to count those ballots. For any ballots that arrive after the rosters have been marked, so at some point the counties are going to give the rosters to the city clerks to give them to the poll workers, the election judges, so they can have them in the polling place on election day. So at the point once the rosters are no longer in the county's possession, they need to then start preparing what we call these supplemental lists of ballots that have been accepted, and those supplemental lists need to then be brought out to the polling places. And again, then the election judges need to mark those rosters as AB prior to the start of voting so that the absentee ballots are counted and again, a voter is not allowed to vote in at the polling place if they have an accepted absentee ballot. After the polls have closed, after 8 o'clock is when counting of the absentee ballots begin. So even though the counties can begin to feed ballots into the machines, they're not able to turn the key, so to speak, to actually produce reports that show what the vote counts are for any of those ballots. That's called counting the ballots, and that can't begin until after 8 p.m. After the polling places have closed. Okay, then we'll talk a little bit about the military and overseas ballots. They're a little bit different in some respects from the regular absentee ballots. Again, these are the ones that we call the UOKAVA ballots at times. And the military overseas ballots are exclusively done by the county auditors. So even though the counties might have designated certain cities to conduct regular absentee voting, the county auditor must do all of the military and overseas absentee voting. Voters in this class really usually apply by what's called the federal postcard application. It's a form set up by the Department of Defense through their federal voting assistance program. And the voters then will use that particular application. They don't have the four reasons. They don't have to have the illness or absence from the precinct types of reasons to vote. So they have to be either in the uniformed service, they could be a spouse or a dependent of the military member, or they could be temporarily or permanently overseas, and those are the reasons then that they would go through this military overseas ballot process. We do have a special website from a link from the Secretary of State's website. It's through the Overseas Vote Foundation. Individuals wanting to complete this form can do a walkthrough with a wizard to complete their absentee application. There are special procedures then that are given to these voters. And the first one is that they can actually receive their blank ballot by email or by fax. So they can also get it mailed, but where a regular voter has to get an absentee ballot mailed to them if they're not coming in person, a military or overseas voter has the option to say they want this blank ballot emailed or faxed to them. However, they still then must print that ballot, they must vote the paper ballot and return the paper ballot by mail in order for us to count it. So it's one-way electronic transmission to the voter as a blank ballot. Anything that's voted or marked has to come back on a paper ballot. The overseas voters also are not required to have a witness like we talked about for the regular ballot. They just have to self-certify on that envelope that they meet all of the conditions and that it's properly completed. The voters in this class also are eligible to vote by what's called the federal write-in absentee ballot. We'll sometimes call that a FWAB. It's really just a way for if they don't get the ballot mailed that was sent to them, they can do what's called a write-in ballot where they write in the actual names of the voters. So they're not using an official ballot. They're just writing down the office, the name that they want to vote for, and they return that information, that ballot then to the county auditors who then will count it as the voters have marked it. And then the ballots are processed similar to the other absentee ballot boards in that there's still a ballot board with times doing replacement ballots, but the ballot board is still doing the accepting and rejecting process for these ballots as well. And I'll turn it over to Debbie to talk about mail balloting.
Mail balloting is a little bit different than the regular absentee ballot process, is that mail balloting is a provision that's allowed in statute for certain precincts that have under 50 voters or those that are outside of the metro area with less than 400 voters, or in some certain special elections that are referenda questions, they are allowed or exclusively required to do mail balloting. When it comes to mail balloting, all voters who typically are pre-registered before the election day are mailed a ballot rather than having a polling place where they can go on election day. The city or township does not have election judges at their polling location. Rather, the voters in those precincts are mailed a ballot prior 30 days to 45 days prior to the election. They are then allowed to fill out that ballot at home, and they can either mail it back to the auditor's office by prepaid postage, or they can return it in person to the auditor's office. On election day, we do have hours staffed at the polling location at the auditor's office from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m., like a regular polling place would, for those voters who choose to bring their ballot in person from those mail ballot precincts, or those voters who may not have been pre-registered and received a ballot in the mail. A voter who was not registered ahead of time and did not automatically receive a ballot must fill out a process similar to an absentee ballot. They need to complete an application, fill it out with all the correct information, and then we will give them a ballot either through the mail or at the counter. Just like the absentee ballot process, the county is required to have a ballot board that reviews the mail ballots as well as they come in that 3 to 5 day window. It's rejected or accepted based on technical administrative issues, not based on matching requirements for signatures or numbers like regular absentees are, because mail ballot voters do not have a requirement to provide, there's no application unless they were not registered, to match those numbers up with. So the election judges are looking for technical deficiencies on the envelopes if there are any there. Mail balloting is used in at least one or more precincts in 53 of the 87 Minnesota counties. And while some precincts have said that there is an increased turnout in voters with mail balloting precincts, the one thing that does occur is that there is administrative work, additional administrative work on the behalf of the cities or counties that are administering mail ballots. Because unlike the absentee ballot process, SVRS does not have a module to support the mail ballot process. So there are no barcodes that we can scan. There are no pre-marked AVs on the rosters when they're printed. Everything is done by hand for the process with mail ballots. Mail ballot voters do not have the ability to go onto the website to track to see if their ballot has been received back or accepted at that point in time. So while there may be a trade-off as far as a higher turnout on election day, on the administrative side of it, on the auditor side of it, there is less functionality with mail ballots, and on the voter side as well from the standpoint of being able to track it.
So I think that was really our prepared presentation. We'd be glad to answer any questions from any of the members.
Thanks to both of you for the presentation. Before we get to other members, I have a couple, and let me start where you finished on the mail-in ballot. I've always found this fascinating, and it's something that a lot of people don't know about, that we have, 46,000 Minnesotans who vote only by mail right now if they live in a township mostly. Do either of you happen to know what the history is behind the 400 cap? Is that something that the townships wanted, didn't want? Do you know when it was set? That sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that it's always been at 400 ever since mail balloting was approved. So I believe it was through the legislative process and through testimony at some point it was agreed upon to do the 400. But I don't know what the pros and cons were that were discussed at that point as to why they settled for 400.
Well, Mr. Poser or Ms. Erickson, do you know when that was instituted, roughly?
Mr. Chair, I know mail balloting has been an option since the mid-1990s, I believe, so it was probably about in that time frame.
Okay. One other follow-up. When you were talking about in-person voting and same-day registration, one of the bullet points on one of the slides talked about authorized proof of residence for same-day registration. Could you flesh out a little bit what counts?
Sure, I can try, and Debbie might have to supplement me if I forget a few. There are several. Obviously, the main one that is used probably 75-80% of the time by a voter is a driver's license or a state ID that has the voter's name and their current address on it. That's by far the most used. I think the second most used would be a photo ID with a utility bill. Those are usually used then by somebody who might have a Minnesota ID or a state Minnesota driver's license or a state ID, but it doesn't have their current address on it. So they would bring along a utility bill. So they would use their photo ID for their name and their photo. And then the utility bill has to be a current utility bill due within 30 days of the election, and that would have the voter's name and address on it. So the combination between the two give the voter's name and their current address. There's also a notice of late registration. So if somebody tried to register within the last 20 days prior to an election, that's too late to get on as a pre-registered voter, but the county then would send that voter a notice of late registration that's mailed then to that person at the address they were attempting to register at. And they can bring that letter in or that notice in as a proof. There's also the student ID that can be used in conjunction with a student housing list. So if the university provides a housing list saying this student name is residing in this campus dormitory, they give that list. That's available to the judges in the polling place. So the student then would have their ID, and the election judge would look at the student housing list to confirm the student's address on campus. Think of anything else? The other fallback, of course, is the voucher. So a voter could have another registered voter, so somebody that is registered in the precinct that knows that person having a prior relationship. It can then sign an oath statement that they know that this individual resides in their precinct.
Well, for both the testifiers, so my understanding is that under current law, the limit is 15. One person can vouch for up to 15 others.
Is that correct? That's correct. It used to be unlimited, and then a few years ago it was changed to 15 as a limit.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from other committee members? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we're talking about using a utility bill, something occurs to me, and I just would like to hear from the Secretary of State's office on the definition of a utility bill. I'll give you a little background. Let's say that I'm an individual who rents an apartment and I don't pay my other utilities, and in this day and age of going wireless, I don't have a landline service. Would a cell phone bill be considered a utility bill in today's definition of utility bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, yes. The proof says regardless of how that service is delivered, a telephone bill is a utility bill.
Mr. Chair, may I add to that as well?
Ms. Erickson?
In addition, they don't have to show the paper bill. If they do not receive their bill by mail, if they get it electronically, they can do one of two things, print it off and bring it to the election judges, or they can even show it on their smartphone to the election judges, as long as the judges can see the name, the voter's name, the address of the bill, and has the photo ID to go along with it. One other item with regard to the utility bill is there are some tenants who may not have separate utilities when they pay their rent. The law does allow for an itemized rent statement that they can receive from their landlord that itemizes out what they pay for rent, including the amount of each utility that they pay. It has to be signed and dated by the landlord within 30 days before or after the election.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I was just handed one other type of proof, and that would be for residents of a nursing home. They could have employees do the vouching as well, so it does allow for the staff of a nursing home to vouch for the residents that reside within those nursing homes as well.
Even though they may not live in the precinct?
Right, even though the employee isn't a registered voter in that precinct. That's correct.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering, how many applicants for absentee ballots are turned down in the election cycle?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, turn down basically would mean that they would have to have an insufficient application.
Insufficient application, whatever.
Right. Either they didn't check a box that gave one of the reasons why they needed an absentee ballot. You know, they didn't check the illness or disability, or they didn't sign the application. Those would be a technical type of situation that the applicant would get a notice back from the county saying, you know, you didn't provide a sufficient application. Until you provide a sufficient application, I cannot provide you with a ballot. But any voter that submits a sufficient application that is properly completed, they wouldn't be turned down.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you ever say that's not a good enough reason for not coming in to vote?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, the reasons on the application are listed on there. They have to check one of the four boxes. There's not just an other box that they can hand write in what their reason is. So if they've checked one of the boxes, they've signed the oath on that application that says that this is a true statement that they're signing.
All right. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Poser. In challenging at the polling place, are challengers limited under by certain conditions the challenger, or can a challenge just be done arbitrarily by a challenger?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mariani, a challenger has to base their challenge based on their personal knowledge. They're required to put that challenge in writing. And then the election judge, they give that form to the election judge, and the election judge then questions the voter. So the challenger isn't addressing the voter themselves, but they have to give, what their personal knowledge is on the form as to what they know about that individual that really allows them to challenge that person's eligibility to vote in that precinct.
member comments, questions? I do have one other one. You talked about absentee balloting. I want to make sure I understand. So that they, as of 5 p.m. on Friday before the election day, that's when you can start feeding absentee ballots into the machine. They're not tallied at that point. You can only tally after the polls close at 8 p.m. on election day. Is that true?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And then what about someone who wants to vote absentee on Monday? Are they completely out, or?
Mr. Chairman, anybody that wants to vote, the absentee voting is still conducted on the Saturday prior to the election and until Monday until 5 p.m. on election prior to the election. So those individuals can still cast an absentee ballot, just that the counties cannot separate the ballots from those envelopes and feed them into a machine until they are sure that the roster has been marked as an AB so that a ballot can't be counted twice. Whereas the counties are required for anything received prior to 5 o'clock on Friday, they are required to have that AB marked on the line prior to the start of voting on Tuesday. And so that's why they're ensured that they can start separating the ballots from anything received by Friday at 5 o'clock. It's just that they need to know the roster line is marked for anything received after that before they start to separate.
Okay, so my next question may be for Ms. Erickson then. So at the election administration level, is Friday at 5 p.m. enough time in your experience? I know you can only directly speak for your county,
Mr.
but do
Chair,
you think generally it would help to have an earlier deadline, assuming, as I do, I guess, that being able to load them in the machine helps in terms of getting results out on time?
Mr. Chair, getting them loaded in the machine definitely helps. From the standpoint of my county, Crow Wing County has about 60,000 residents. We have just under 40,000 registered voters, and we did short just shy of 8,000 absentee ballots in the last 2012 election, in the general election. So that's kind of a frame of reference. To allow to make sure that we have everything entered, it took staff approximately 2 days to get everything entered, fed into the machines, and that's beginning at 5 o'clock the Friday before. We actually spend the whole day on Saturday and the whole day on Monday prior to the election to get everything entered. While 5 o'clock on Friday allows us to have an opportunity to get all the rosters pre-printed ahead of time, we are scrambling because we do need to make sure that those ballots are entered as accepted by the ballot board, entered into SVRS. The rosters have to be generated, which can take a couple of hours through the system. When you have 87 counties who are all trying to generate rosters at the same time, the system can only handle so much. We have to print, and we can only print as quickly as what our printers will print them and get them ready to go out to the polls so that they're ready for pickup on Monday. The ability then to have any ballots that come in on the Saturday, the Monday, or by 3 o'clock on election day, voters can return ballots, not themselves, but other ballots can be returned by mail or by agent delivery by 3 o'clock on election day. And we then have to coordinate with the precincts to ensure that voter has not already voted before the ballot is accepted and placed into the machine. The deadline is doable, but additional time always helps.
Just, Ms. Erickson, one other just follow-up to what you just said, and maybe I wasn't following it. So if someone votes by absentee and then changes their mind and wants to claw back their absentee ballot, what is the deadline for doing that?
Mr. Chair, the deadline for taking back would be the 5 o'clock Friday prior to the election.
Okay. So then if a person votes absentee Friday, let's say, and over the weekend sees an ad or sees something in the newspaper or on television and wants to change it, that's it. They're out.
That, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Their ballot has already been counted.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just follow up on my question, both for Mr. Poser and Ms. Erickson, on challenges. I'm just kind of intrigued by this, and partly because in the past I've heard complaints from constituents about being challenged in polls. So the only way you can challenge is to do it in writing. Is that correct? It has to. You can't, verbally in front of a voter say, "Hey, I'm challenging this person." That person would need to quickly submit something in writing to the judge. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mariani, that's correct. If it's going to be a challenger making the challenge, there might be a pre-printed challenge on the roster from some other method.
Sure.
But if a challenger in the polling place is challenging, they must put that in writing. That's correct.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Poser, that makes sense to me because obviously you don't want to create an environment or an atmosphere that might be intimidating to to voters. Our challenges that are written, that are that are done properly, are those discoverable? Or are those, is that information that is could be made available to the public to ascertain behavior in a given polling place?
Mr. Poser?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, I'm not aware that anybody's ever asked for those, so I think it would probably be up to the data practices officer within the county. I think it would have to be a data practices request in order to attempt to get those, and I don't know that anybody has, so I'm not an attorney, so I don't think I can properly answer your question.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Poser, possibly covered by some kind of data privacy, or maybe just simply never, done. Are there any penalties for falsely challenging an individual, a potential voter?
Mr. Poser?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, I believe this is in Chapter 204C, so I believe there's something at the end. I mean, I think that they would be subject to some penalties through a complaint through the county attorney. I think the county attorney would need to investigate that, but I would believe at the end of Chapter 204C there's some penalties there that I think might encompass a challenger.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other member comments? Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Poser, just a question. You talked about the statewide voter registration system. Who has access to that system? It's my understanding that the counties must have access to that system, or the cities, and an individual voter, if they wanted to check their status, would have access. Do other outside organizations have access to that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dowd, the actual access to the system is limited to the county auditors and any cities that have either been delegated or they might have a view-only access to do local absentee voting. Any voter, the individual that wants to know about registered voters really needs to complete a form, and the election official would provide them with information from the public information list, but an individual would not have access to the system itself. And the system is really, I should say that all of the counties, they come through their static IP addresses, so we know, we limit it only to known IP addresses that we allow into access into the system as well. So you can't just get to it through any website and log into our system.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that answers my question. What made me think of it was the talk about data practices. We don't allow access to this information by political parties or outside organizations or anything like that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dowd, the political parties might have access through the public information list. So both of the major parties actually subscribe to a daily public information list, but they get what's on the public information list. And other individuals need to apply and get an actual disk or something with whatever it is that they've requested.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Posner, can you let us know what percentage of voter turnout we had in Minnesota this year, and if we were number one again, and who comes close?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, yes, Minnesota had the highest voter turnout again in the nation. And now you're going to make me think, but I think on our eligible, we base it on the voting eligible population, and I believe that was 76%, sorry. But we were at least 2 or 3 points, I think, ahead of the next state percentage-wise.
I have a question about the databases that you mentioned in one of your initial slides. I know that there are several databases, and this can be for either of you, of course, that you run through new registrants, same-day registrants is my understanding. How fresh is that data? I mean, are you satisfied or not, and maybe the answer is different for the different databases, that it is fresh, up-to-date data, whether it's on felons, whether it's on deaths, what have you. And then a question, I know I'm veering into kind of a policy issue, if you care to venture or give a position on whether there are other databases to which you wish you had access or would make things smoother or even better. So the first question is it fresh stuff? The second is, are there other databases that would help?
Mr. Chairman, the court's information that we receive is fresh daily as somebody enters an event into the court system. If there is a felony conviction or a release of a restoration of their rights after a felony conviction through the courts, that information is almost immediate into our system. And similarly, the deaths from the Department of Health we used to get on a monthly basis, and we've since switched to get that on a daily basis. So that information is fresh. And the information, when a record is put into the system that night, if there's been a change to a name or an address or if it's a completely new person to our system, that night we send that information to the Department of Vehicle Services, and the next morning they have returned to us information trying to match that information. So that information is fresh. I think as far as the Department of Corrections information, we get that at different times. It's not on a we do it so many weeks before every election, so many weeks after every election, and do some of those types of matching, so we don't have a live connection to Department of Corrections data. And I'm not sure if I really am interested in speaking to any other
That's
policy
all right.
types.
We can leave that for another hearing, I guess. Anything to add, Ms. Erickson?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We, on a daily basis, are getting updates and reviewing all of our information with regard to any registrations that we've either updated or added, so we find it very timely.
Okay. Any other comments? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Poser, I don't think I missed this earlier, but did you say how many absentee ballots we had in the last election, and is there a trend? Compared to the past elections?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, I believe the absentee ballots that were accepted in 2012 was right around the 290,000 range. I think that was fairly close to what it was in 2008. So obviously it kind of goes in cycles. The presidential elections have more absentee ballots than the non-presidential elections. So it cycles that way, but I think we've held fairly steady between 2008 and 2012 as far as accepted absentee ballots.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, seeing none, our next hearing, same time, same place, on Thursday, where we'll have an overview by campaign finance and some testimony about some voting delays. The meeting is adjourned.